If you were a fan of The Sopranos, you've no doubt been eagerly waiting for Edie Falco's next TV debut. The people, be cool, because she might not want to hear it.
I don't like chatty, okay? I don't do chatty. I like quiet. Quiet and mean. Those are my people.
That's Edie Falco in her new role as Nurse Jackie, a name I particularly like. Nurse Jackie is not just the name of her character. It's the name of the show, a new hospital drama that debuts tomorrow on Showtime. And as the name suggests, Edie Falco is center stage, and you're center stage with us now. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
From the opening sequence, we see that Nurse Jackie is addicted to some little red pills.
Oops.
So why introduce this? It's a compelling element, but making her an addict is also unusual.
I think that her life is very complicated. There are many aspects of it that are mutually exclusive. And in my worldly experience, I've discovered that people who have lots of things in their lives that don't really fit together have to find some way to kind of deny that it's happening. And she lives in a place where lots of pills can be found, so it seemed to make a perfect match to me.
Edie Falco, can I ask you something about your own worldly experience?
Go on.
That you bring to this. I read in preparing for this that you had at one time struggled with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a correspondence between your struggle and what you're bringing to this character?
I'm sure there must be. My experience is that if you have ever struggled with addiction, you're always struggling with addiction. It's a personality trait, really. You learn how to kind of keep it at bay through many years of whatever your journey may be, therapy or 12-step programs or whatever. So it is a mindset I understand deeply. And I'm sure that went into my portrayal of Jackie. I never really know specifically, but I'm sure that's in there.
Mm-hmm. I also felt that she was just fascinatingly complex. Besides admiring her name, which I hope the writers went through a lot
this is why we did it, just so you know. Go on.
She's in a secondary role to mm-hmm. the doctors, often,
sure.
as nurses
sure.
can be. Let's listen to a scene where she shows that she's not just going to accept everything that comes along.
Dr. Cooper?
Coop! Call me Coop.
Dr. Cooper.
Nurse Jackie.
So what's up?
What can I do for you?
What you can do for me is this. You can stay the out of my way. That's what you can do for me.
You mean it is the sink?
No. What I need is for you to know that I know you. I have seen hundreds of you blow through these doors. You've graduated, top 10, top 5% of your class, right? Test scores through the roof, but a total retard when it comes to actual patients. I know you. I just had to sit there and look that kid's mother in the eye and tell her that we did everything we could, you dumb. That was my patient. I told you he was slipping, and he was. When I tell you to order a scan, you order a scan, because if you don't do it, I'll just go to the next doctor and the next doctor after that. In the meantime, that kid died, and it is all on you.
This is a really strong woman, and while I don't know you personally, I get the feeling that was important to you personally.
Well, I think the situation with Jackie would be similar no matter what she did for a living. I think she's passionate and smart, and wherever she ended up in her life, she would end up being probably the best at doing it. And she sticks to it for a long time so that she can be the best at doing it. I think she's been a nurse forever and ever. So I think had that doctor been a woman, her reaction would have been the same. I think she doesn't want anyone to get in the way of her getting done what needs to get done because she knows how it needs to get done. So I respect that in any person, mm-hmm. a man or a woman or a kid, for heaven's sake. If there is someone who may be in status-wise in a higher place, it's irrelevant because the work that needs to get done is of primary importance.
The other thing that really comes through that I thought accurate is the incredible weariness that people have undergoing that, the kind of almost out-of-body tiredness. And you let the character's weariness really show. And I just had to ask, did you have any qualms about that, letting the frownies appear, letting the lines be etched?
No, I don't. I've spent a lot of years getting those frown lines, and I've enjoyed every second of it. And I'm very attached to myself. Let me rephrase that. I'm very attached to my face, I mean, we've been together a long time. I wouldn't want to change anything about it. And I have no desire to portray people looking a way that they don't look naturally. I just don't understand that impulse. So I've also never gotten anything in my life because of the way I look. And I've never not gotten anything important to me because of the way I look. So it's irrelevant to me. You know, I am who I am, and I'm not being holier than thou about it. I genuinely feel that way.
Edie Falco, what is it like to have an entire show centered on you? This is a half-hour show as opposed to an hour, but it is, you know, you are front center and the theme line.
Mm. I like it. It's very fancy. No, I actually do like it, though. I'm a very hard worker, and it got embarrassing on Sopranos because half the time I wanted to be there even if I wasn't working, just because I like to be around what's going on. Mm-hmm. I like to be involved in my work, in lots of aspects of it. I felt sad that I missed all kinds of stuff on Sopranos because I wasn't working that day. And here I'm working. I'm there all the time. I'm there from the, when people are saying hello in the morning till they're, wearily walking out the door 13 hours later. I just love it. I really have never felt so intrinsically connected to the action, It suits me.
Edie Falco. She joined us from our New York bureau. Nurse Jackie airs Monday, June 8th on Showtime. It has been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.
That said, many states do want to become backdrops for movies, and if they succeed, unemployed people may line up to become extras, faces in the crowd on screen. They almost never speak on camera, but some make a pretty good living, which explains some long lines for work in the capital of the movie industry. People are lining up at Hollywood's Central Casting, where anybody can register as an extra. Anthea Raymond reports.
In an industrial park in Burbank, California, at least 100 people are standing in line, some for hours, as aspiring extras do every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Are you signing up for the first time?
Or
first time. Welcome to Central Casting.
Thank you, sir.
They won't audition. They won't pull out their headshots. They'll just pay their $25, and they're an extra.
This is the only job that all you need is a Social Security number and a pulse. They don't ask what you did before. Okay, people that get out of jail can do this. Anyone can do it. The thing is how bad you want it.
Veteran extra Alan Perlstein is in line next to Kiana Patterson. She's signing up for the first time. 7 months ago, she moved from Indianapolis to L.A. to be an actress.
This is kind of like a stepping stone, and I've heard a lot about Central Casting. I heard it was great, so I might as well get in there and try it.
Patterson doesn't want to be an extra forever. She wants a speaking part in an A-list film soon. But for now, she'll take this job where she brings her own costume and makes just $64 a day. Sure, extra work isn't only about the money, but lately, extra cash has been on the minds of newcomers. Jennifer Bender is a vice president at Central Casting.
A lot of people are getting laid off, so we have quite a variety of people coming in looking for ways to make extra money. And, it's a good way to supplement their income until they can figure out what they're going to do with their next career.
Bender says Central Casting is flooded in every recession, and new signups are up 10% from a year ago. And Bender says production is way down, so there are fewer jobs than ever. But 48-year-old Michael Pierce says he's busy. Pierce flew a commuter plane for a Delta contractor until a year ago.
A lot of things just got slow. The airlines are always cutting back, and my direct boss died, and they canceled his contract. And I've flown for him for so long. To transition at my age to one of the majors, it's just not possible.
Pierce had always wanted to try acting, and he says it helps to be older. There's less competition for parts as judges, teachers, and attorneys. Tony Young makes a lot of his income as an extra. He says he'd counted on a regular gig at the primetime series Grey's Anatomy.
Lately, I've been calling no more regularly than normal and getting almost nothing. And I think a lot of it has to do with just too many people out there.
Young says few will have the drive and discipline to stay in the game. Central Casting estimates that, even in good times, 9 out of every 10 new extras don't last a year. For NPR News, I'm Anthea Raymond in Los Angeles.
The biggest book convention in North America wrapped up over the weekend in New York City. It's called Book Expo America. Much of the buzz this year was about how the recession has hurt the publishing industry, of course, but one genre, romance novels, is doing quite well, and that includes ethnic romances. This morning we have an appreciation of Elsie B. Washington. She's the woman who started the ball rolling with the first contemporary African-American romance novel. She passed away last month, and we have more this morning from NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates.
Some people sneer at paperback romance novels, but they're the most prolific, profitable arm of the publishing industry. And until 1980, all the damsels being clasped to hard male chests were white. Lots of passion, zilch diversity. Then, under the pen name Rosalind Wells, journalist Elsie Washington published Entwined Destinies. It's widely considered the first contemporary black romance. Gwendolyn Osborne is a contributor to The Romance Reader, a popular website for online reviews. She recaps the storyline.
Entwined Destinies was the story of an African-American magazine writer who is sent to London to cover an oil conference, and she meets this African-American man, Lloyd Craig, who is part of a multinational oil conglomerate.
Sparks fly in short order, but for the first time, they were flying between people of color and means. Janice Sims had been trying to publish her own black romance back then with no luck.
Nobody was interested in my books. I couldn't find anyone who was publishing African-American stories with African-American hero and heroine who were, let's put it this way, upwardly mobile, not from the ghetto or anything, you know what I mean?
Washington's work, populated as it was with well-educated, well-traveled, worldly blacks, was a delight to black readers and aspiring writers. Driving to Book Expo, Rochelle Allers told me she could still recall her elation at discovering this trailblazing book.
It's almost like the, you know, what people felt when Barack Obama was elected president. You know, they said, you know, we can do this. And that's what I felt when I saw Elsie's book.
Allers, who has now sold almost 2 million books, says she was just as thrilled to see Washington's cover.
Oh, my God. The people on the cover look like me.
That was a definite difference. Guided by Vivian Stevens, the first black romance editor, Washington spun a tale with all the traditional romance elements. Attraction, longing, obstacles to overcome, and ultimately commitment, set against a glamorous international backdrop. Suddenly, black wasn't only poor or pathological. It wasn't just victims. Gwen Osborne.
The important thing about Elsie's work is that it established the romance novels that followed in the next 20 years as books about the African-American middle class.
In fact, Washington brought the black middle class front and center before the Huxtables became America's favorite black TV family. Entwined Destinies was Washington's first and only novel. It's now out of print, but its effects are still being felt by the current crop of successful black romance novelists like Allers and Sims. Sims says Washington's work inspired her to expand her own boundaries.
She really opened that up for me. And I know she did the same thing for a lot of other African-American romance novelists.
Elsie Washington died in New York on May 5th after a long illness. She was 66 years old. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. In Your Health Today, we'll report on two ways to improve what nature gave you. In a moment, we'll hear about risky silicone injections for wrinkles. First, a cosmetic surgery technique to transfer fat from one part of the body to another. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
If you've never thought of body fat as a precious resource, well, it's likely you've never met surgeon David Broadway. He's an early adopter of a technique that aims to redistribute fat. Think of it as the Robin Hood approach to plastic surgery, taking from the fat-rich parts of the body and giving to the poor, or the just modestly endowed.
Well, I've been doing fat transfer to multiple areas for quite some time. We've been using it in combination with a liposuction technique that we've described as high-definition liposuction. And rather than simply discard the fat, we'll take that fat and inject it into the breast area.
This quick fix concept may have a Made in America ring to it, but turns out most early pioneers are in Japan and Europe. And what they've learned is that recycling fat is no simple task. The process of extracting it from the body can damage the fat, and once it's injected back in, it doesn't always get the blood supply it needs, so some of the fat doesn't survive.
Well, usually we'll get about 40 to 80% of the fat to take.
It's a big variable there, 40 to 80, I guess.
It is a variable. That's one of the disadvantages. You're not entirely sure what the end result will be.
Patient Christina Stone opted for the surgery 2 years ago. She said she wanted larger breasts, but she'd been hesitant about implants.
I knew going in that there was no guarantee, but I was very interested in the fact that I wasn't going to have, you know, silicone or anything in my body.
The plan was to take fat from her thighs and abdomen and inject a lot of it, more than she needed, into her breasts, knowing that some of it wouldn't take.
They had warned me, you know, when you wake up, don't be shocked because they're going to be a lot bigger than you want them to be.
But she says the moment the anesthesia wore off, her expectations of adding 2 cups to her bra size were dashed.
So immediately I looked down and I didn't see any difference. I mean, a little.
That must have been really disappointing for you.
It was. You know, I was pretty, you know, sad about it.
Stone later had a second surgery to get implants, and she says she's happy with the results. But her surgeon, Dr. Scott Speer, says he wants to know more. He explains, until recently, fat transfers were mainly performed as reconstructive surgeries, for instance, in breast cancer patients after a mastectomy.
In the reconstruction patients, I think it's pretty well agreed it has real value. But for pure breast enlargement, I think we're just at the beginning of the learning curve on that.
Speer's heading up a clinical trial to help answer some questions, such as what's the best way to perform the procedure, and what are the risks? One concern has been calcifications in the breast tissue that appear after the procedure, which could make it harder to detect breast cancer if a woman were to develop it down the line. And another question is, could putting fat into the breast stimulate development of disease?
There's always been a question with regard to fat in the female breast, and, you know, it's unanswered.
That's surgeon John Millard of Lone Tree, Colorado. He says clinical trials will be helpful. For now, he says, he's very comfortable with the results he's seeing using fat transfers to re-sculpt many other parts of the body. For instance, he's pioneered a technique to beef up men's pecs by injecting fat right into these chest muscles.
I like to describe the augmentation of the male pectoralis. We're taking a piece of filet mignon and turning it into Kobe beef. We're actually putting fat into the muscle.
And according to Millard's patient, Brad Hamilton, who's had the procedure, it works.
You know, it looks like you've been working out for years.
I guess to me, I'm confused by that because I think about shooting fat into the muscle, you think that you'd get sort of a fatty look up top. But what you're saying is that you look more muscular.
Yeah, it actually defines and enhances your muscle.
Hamilton says he knows it's early days for these procedures. There are no long-term studies and no guarantees that the results will last. But he says at 45, as gravity pulls, he's pushing back. Alice Naubrey, NPR News.